Studio 360 is supported by Sacred Heart University, with a graduate school in film and television. This one-year master's program is devoted to cinematic storytelling and hands-on production. Applications are being accepted for fall. Information at ftma.sacredheart.edu.
On today's episode of Studio 360, Tarzan, the man raised in the jungle by apes, battles with the temptations of the civilized metropolis.
Low point come when Tarzan climb tree and park. Do Tarzan yell for tourist, get money for drug.
An original Tarzan of the Apes story.
By Jack Handy.
And a Cockney girl from London gets into a battle of wills with a punctilious professor who wishes her to speak properly.
The play is really about language, the idea that through language one can raise one's social status, which is something that's really important for that era.
Plus, the new musical craze that looks to eclipse ragtime on pianos all over America. The Blues. This is Kurt Anderson. All that and more is just ahead in this hour of Studio 360's 1914 Time Capsule from Public Radio International and WNYC. Right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com. Personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by Lookout, working to protect people and organizations from mobile threats with 50 million users worldwide. More information at Lookout.com.
This is Studio 360.
100 years from today.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for a special episode of the Studio 360 program. This is your host, Kurt Anderson. In today's program, we present to you through the medium of radio some singular developments taking place in the arts today. In literature, drama, music, and the medium of moving pictures, new technologies and new ideas are changing what we, the American people, create and how we are entertained. Some of these new innovations appear startling at first, but we believe they hold great promise for the development of a truly modern culture in the United States. It may not be too bold to speculate that later generations will look back upon 1914 as a remarkable year, perhaps as the year in which the 20th century truly began. We begin with a man familiar to Americans young and old, though most of us would not recognize him if we met in the street. Winsor McCay is a cartoonist for the Hearst newspapers. He's achieved a singular reputation among his peers as the creator of Little Nemo, a scamp who climbs high-rise buildings in his dreams. Now Mr. McCay is experimenting with a new technique that combines drawing with moving pictures to create a cartoon which moves before our eyes. To understand it and Mr. McCay's work better, we shall hear now from Art Spiegelman, himself a writer and graphic artist of renown.
The comic is such an urban form because it's made of...
buildings.
Buildings.
High-rises.
Yeah, it's made of these stacked-up little windows, you know? So it's almost specific to the Sunday comics, which came before the daily comics.
Winsor McCay was particularly interested in the new skyscrapers and the people in them, what it meant to be a modern office drone.
He approached the comics very personally, and you can see the reverb between his daily life and the comics that he was making, like an early strip he did called A Pilgrim's Progress, is about this top-hatted guy carrying a suitcase that's called Dull Care, and he just tries to get rid of the dull care and just leave it somewhere and run away, and by the end of the strip, it's delivered back to him. There's no escaping his yoke of the day job.
So McCay started playing around with something new, animation. He created some of the first cartoon movies ever. He started by adapting characters from his comic strips, like Little Nemo. But in 1914, he got more ambitious. He created an original character called Gertie the Dinosaur. He'd show a Gertie film in a theater and appear live on stage with it, interacting with his cartoon on the screen.
Yeah, and there's one moment where he's throwing... toss a giant pumpkin, then it would appear as a tiny little pea-sized thing that would... be gulped down as a snack by Gertie.
At the time, dinosaurs were still a pretty new and unfamiliar idea to people. Art Spiegelman and I watched the silent film together on YouTube. It's a simple line drawing. There are little cards in the spots where McCay would have spoken to Gertie. He coaxes her out of the cave. She's shy and, for a brontosaurus, kind of dainty.
It was definitely performative. Originally, there were no real movie theaters, so it was part of vaudeville.
But wasn't there a Nickelodeon industry? He could have shipped this out to the Nickelodeon.
Probably was, but he was already a successful vaudeville star. He was known as the lightning sketch artist, and part of it would be a spotlight appears on the audience member who stands up and volunteers. Then the lights would go out a few seconds later, and in the dark, McKay would draw that person's portrait. That was part of his act.
Uh-huh.
And this then became part of the act as well.
I mean, again, it's in a certain sense primitive, but not really. The emotion this dinosaur dancing around.
Yeah, it's like a puppy.
Yeah. And he kind of invented the method of animation. Walt Disney, 7 years later, started making his shorts.
Well, they owed a lot to him. But, but he wasn't the very first. In fact, he worked for a couple of the people who were also among the pioneers, but he upped the ante greatly. McKay was a very significant practitioner in perfecting things like being able to peg the drawing so you could get the background just right when you drew it again, like so the next drawing would be in exactly the same spot on the piece of paper when you were shooting that one, and inventing this notion of keyframes where you take the high points and then fill in between, things like that. And he didn't want to patent his inventions. He thought this was a gift to the world for a new art form.
And his boss, William Randolph Hearst, stopped him from doing this.
A jealous boss.
Why was that? You'd think it would be brand extension. It would be good for everybody.
You know, Hearst had wars to fight that were brand extensions, you know. So the main thing was he thought this guy was slacking off on what he could deliver for the newspaper. And in fact, you know, what he would do when he had the vaudeville act is he'd be doing his strips for Hearst in the green room, basically. It didn't suffer for it. He was an absolutely committed artist.
But for all this multimedia commercial razzle-dazzle, as you say, he thought animation was an art and, I've read, was upset when it became commercialized and when Max Fleischer made Betty Boop cartoons.
Well, Max Fleischer introduced him at some kind of evening to honor his contribution to animation late in McKay's life. And for whatever reason, he started in a rant about this has just been turned into a business and it was always meant to be an art. And he was rather excoriating of the people who had let that happen.
So do you think 100 years from now, a couple of guys like us will be sitting around talking about Winsor McKay? Does he have a permanent legacy?
Well, you know, they just are things that remind me of something that Steinberg once said to my wife, who's the art editor up at the New Yorker.
This is Saul Steinberg.
Yeah, who famous for his view of U.S. from 9th Avenue, among many other things. But what he was saying, my goal is to make something that once you've seen it, you cannot ever have not seen it. That it informs your way of seeing after that. And that seems like as good a goal as any for an artist to work from. And I believe that McKay accomplished that quite a few times over.
Thank you, Professor Spiegelman. Art Spiegelman is the creator of Mouse and In the Shadow of No Towers. You can find a video of Winsor McKay's animated dinosaur Gertie at Studio360.org.
That's a real movie.
And I am Kurt Anderson, presenting today's program about the striking cultural developments taking place now in 1914. The moving pictures have thoroughly captured the attention of the public. Indeed, some have said that the movies could spell the doom of vaudeville and live drama. However, many actors accustomed to the stage have found that performing for a camera offers new opportunities for their art. Such a man is Charlie Chaplin, the popular music hall comedian. Chaplin has been acting in films produced by the Keystone Pictures Studio in Los Angeles. This year alone, he appeared in several short films as a tramp. Already a success with audiences, we can expect appearances by the tramp in moving pictures for years, perhaps even as far in the future as, say, 1936. And now, Miss Sarah Fishko of radio station WNYC brings us the history of Mr. Chaplin's tramp.
When the story of Charlie Chaplin is told, it always comes to that touching moment. That moment where Chaplin realizes that his finest creation, his tramp character, the silent screen's most enduring image, has become outdated. Technology has moved on. The silent film era is over. Chaplin himself has changed. What's a legend to do?
Can you imagine the tramp talking?
It's the future, Charlie.
Not in my lifetime.
The moment is immortalized in the 1992 biopic Chaplin, starring Robert Downey Jr.
The tramp can't talk. The minute he talks, he's dead.
But talking was the last thing on Chaplin's mind decades earlier when he was starting out in the movies. He'd arrived in Hollywood just when silent films were at their beginnings, moving pictures having just advanced past the Nickelodeon era.
He first went to Keystone after a career in the English music halls in December of 1913.
Chuck Mayland is author of Chaplin and American Culture.
And within a couple of months of the time that he arrived in Los Angeles, he had gotten that costume that we associate so much with Chaplin, the tramp costume.
Efforts to attribute the creation of the tramp costume to a prolonged period of considered artistic thought have failed. The truth of it is that Charlie Chaplin had 5 minutes to throw something together for a scheduled shoot, and he grabbed whatever he could find in the wardrobe room at Keystone.
He called it a series of contradictions: the baggy trousers, the tight coat, the small hat, the large shoes.
Jeffrey Vance's book is Chaplin, Genius of the Cinema.
The walking stick was to suggest a gentleman. The mustache was to make him appear older, as well as being a little silly, because he thought at that time that he had a sad, serious face, and he felt that the mustache made him look comic without hiding his expression.
I had no idea of the character, Chaplin wrote later, but the moment I was dressed, the clothes and the makeup made me feel the person he was.
He always said that the tramp was a comic spirit inside of him that needed to be expressed.
In those early silent comedies, the tramp was all things, a waiter in Dough and Dynamite, a piano mover in His Music Career, and a self-important city slicker in Tilly's Punctured Romance. In the film Work, he played a paper hanger's assistant, confounded by glue.
It was a sense of just laughing. You went to see Charlie Chaplin because he made you laugh so hard.
Actor Norman Lloyd was born in 1914, the same year Charlie started making pictures. So Lloyd, like any American kid in that period, grew up watching The Tramp.
And I remember, it would have been about 1915, 1916, having a little toy Charlie Chaplin. It had a cane and it had the derby. You wound it up, and it could walk with Charlie's walk of the amazing shoes.
Nowadays, you'd call it merchandising. In those days, it was part of something one member of the press called Chaplinitis.
Products started to appear that used that tramp character. Things like paper dolls and figurines, squirt gun rings.
And as early as 1915, only a year into Charlie's film career, people gathered around the country for Chaplin imitation nights, mastering the tramp's facial twitches and unmistakable waddle. Almost instantly, Charles Chaplin had gone from street urchin in extreme poverty to silent movie master of a kind of extreme stardom that the world had literally never known.
And he never lost that feeling of being a poor person, eating secondhand fruit and stealing it off wagons with his brother Sidney and so on.
Norman Lloyd, after growing up watching Chaplin, became an actor in some of his films and a friend and for years a tennis partner of Chaplin's.
Now he became a multimillionaire and he lived in luxury. There was a staff in the house, I don't know exactly how many people, but a butler, cook, a nanny, gardener, etc. There must have been about 10 people. He liked to live that way, and he thought of himself as royalty in a certain sense. But down deep was still that fellow who came from this terrible poverty.
That fellow appeared in roughly 50 films in 1914 and 15 alone. During this period, Chaplin made a film called The Tramp, forever naming and cementing his character in the minds of filmgoers. He was pursuing the farmer's daughter in that one, pitted against her dishonest, scheming fiancé. By now, Chaplin was developing his remarkable and very expensive method of improvising with cameras rolling.
He had to rehearse and basically work out his ideas on film so he could see himself, because he was not only the actor, but he was the director.
At the Mutual Film Corporation, where he went to work in 1916, he made the celebrated film The Rink, and no one ever skated as Charlie did. In one scene on skates, he hooked his cane, a staple of the tramp costume, to a moving automobile and hung on, escaping a horde of angry skaters and police who were giving chase. He even attracted the attention of the great Russian dancer Nijinsky, who visited the set to watch Chaplin's graceful roller skating pratfalls.
And suddenly, Nijinsky starts to cry. Sob. These loud sobs. Charlie says, cut. Stop. Skate show. He says, Nijinsky, what is it? And Nijinsky says, oh, Charlie, you're so funny.
In every appearance, Charlie played to the contradictory character that went with his costume. He was elegant and tattered, terrified and brave, roguish and modest, goofy and incurably romantic all at once.
He wasn't just this funny man with this distinctive silhouette. He was Charlie Chaplin. And the world just couldn't get enough Chaplin product.
When movies went from one and two reelers to full-length features, Chaplin was there, expanding his characters and stories. The Kid from 1921, with the tramp and the young Jackie Coogan, was Chaplin's first full-length film and one of the first hour-long films made by anyone. It told the touching story of an abandoned child who, in baggy pants and big shoes, becomes like a son to the tramp, only to be separated from him in a heart-rending finale. Stories like that were a whole new element in Chaplin's films.
They began to exhibit pathos. That is, audiences would really empathize with the tramp character when things did not necessarily go well with him.
Chaplin's Little Tramp continued into the 20s, striking it rich in the classic The Gold Rush. Soon after, sound happened, spoken words. In 1927, the first talkie, the jazz singer, forced filmmakers to completely rethink how films were made.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet. Wait a minute, I tell you. You ain't heard nothing.
It was the start of something big, but it was also the end of something.
It was a huge, incredibly sudden shutting down of a kind of expressiveness.
Film critic and filmmaker Richard Schickel directed Charlie, The Life and Art of Charles Chaplin.
People like George Lucas have said to me that he didn't feel that visually the movies have yet recovered from the impact of sound coming to them. And there may be something in that.
The choreographic quality of movies changed.
People started grouping around hidden microphones. You know, they have a microphone in a flower pot, and there'd be four people sitting around a table trying to talk into the microphone. And, you know, that just rendered the movies incredibly static very quickly.
Charlie Chaplin resisted the change with a vengeance. Moving pictures need sound, he said in 1928, as much as Beethoven's symphonies need lyrics. 4 years after sound came in, Charlie stayed silent with City Lights, released in 1931 with just music and a few sound effects. City Lights outgrossed most of the talking pictures of the era. Then came Modern Times. It was Chaplin's response to the Great Depression and his view of the terrors of automation. In Modern Times, there are copious amounts of music and some talk, which comes from an Orwellian screen occupied by the company president, who observes Charlie on his breaks and barks commands to factory workers.
Quit stalling. Get back to work. Go on.
But Charlie and his partner, Paulette Goddard, never speak. This approach resulted in one of the most famous images in the history of cinema. Charlie in the gears of the assembly line.
You know, it's just a brilliant comic sequence.
With a few seconds of silent film, Chaplin was able to make statements about industrial politics and make us laugh. He did everything but talk. There's even a scene in Modern Times where the tramp sings a nonsense song to a restless cafe crowd, making up the words as he goes. Singing was one thing, but as Chaplin said later, if I talked, I'd be like any other comedian. And there was his voice to consider.
You see, I think our form is only really a great form by virtue of its limitations.
Chaplin, in an interview from 1951.
It's like paintings in two dimensions. You get your great masters, like Rembrandt and so forth. And it's the same thing in the silent films, you see. The moment we put language to them, they heard the, and it was vocal and audible, and we heard... We had some very bad experiences, or very dull ones at least.
Modern Times was not nearly the end of Chaplin's movie career, but it was indeed the end, as they say, of an era. In fact, in that film, Charlie, as the tramp, along with his waif-like pal, walked down that dusty road for the last time.
The tramp is a figure that's uniquely dependent upon there being an open road for him to stroll down at the end of the movie. That figure was, among other things, a great exemplar of personal freedom. You just up and go. Well, it got harder and harder to up and go in the 30s and 40s. You know, there were oppressive dictators on every hand. There was industrialism. I think the world was really closing in on the tramp, and his demise as a comic figure was, I think, inevitable.
Now there's so much that is realistic that there's very little left to the imagination.
It's poignant, the thought of Chaplin making a film about man surviving the modern age with humanity intact, all the while holding on to his own methods and his own humanity as he watched technology move forward. We still recognize the tramp, of course, but we know him differently now, not so much as that deliciously contradictory character, but more as a reminder of a poetic moment when pictures were everything. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Fischko.
Still to come on this special installment of the Studio 360 program, a musical craze from the Old South that's now sweeping every section of the nation. Not ragtime. Ragtime is passé. The popular music of 1914, the blues.
I never will forget the tune that Andy called the Memphis Blues.
That and much more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360, produced and presented by the PRI Broadcasting System and WNYC. Please stay tuned.
Studio 360 is supported by Sacred Heart University, with a graduate school in film and television. This one-year master's program is devoted to cinematic storytelling and hands-on production. Applications are being accepted for fall. Information at ftma.sacredheart.edu.
Good day, Studio 360 listeners. This is your host, Kurt Anderson, speaking. We return now to our special program on the cultural developments making 1914 a landmark topsy-turvy year for the popular arts in America. Mr. W.C. Handy of Memphis, Tennessee, has made a name for himself by publishing popular songs of a music called the blues. Blues songs are common in the Deep South, where the lyrics are passed from person to person, generation to generation. They were little known outside that region until recently.
Ever since Miss Susan Johnson lost her jockey lean, there's been much excitement for to be. You can hear her morning, night, and morn.
Now Mr. Handy's Yellow Dog Blues is being played on pianos all over America. We asked our listeners to play or sing their own versions of the song and send a copy to our producers. Today, the songwriter Mark Anthony Thompson, also known by the stage name Chocolate Genius, joins me to discuss the contributions.
Mark Anthony Thompson, welcome back to Studio 360.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we challenged our listeners to create their own unique interpretations of this 100-year-old Yellow Dog Blues. There were, among the submissions, some gorgeous, acoustic, rootsy, more obviously bluesy renditions. None of those were your absolute top favorites.
You know, for anybody that submitted and is listening, I know what it's like because I email someone a new song. I don't hear back from them for an hour. I'm heartbroken. So I listened to all these. And my criteria for me was something that forget about the song, forget about the, you know, the dedication to the original intent. I just wanted something that I really like to listen to.
As a piece of music
exactly,
now.
Exactly, as a piece of music now. And I also gave a little bit more credence to people that I thought really put some effort into the conception of it.
And I understand you had a little bit of trouble picking a winner.
Oh, it was really
hard. This is our first listener challenge in which we've had a tie. So you've made history here.
Maybe it's your first judge that's indecisive is what it actually is.
Mercurial. I'm glad to have you admit your mercurialism. So tell us who the two winners are.
I really like Sir Kelly Pratt.
Now, Kelly Pratt, what did you love about this version, which we're hearing now?
I really liked the production. I liked the drumming, and I liked his voice. I thought it was inventive.
It's like if Radiohead did a blues cover.
You know? Kind of, yes.
By the way, I don't know if this bore any effect in your judging, but Kelly Pratt is a professional musician, has played brass with Arcade Fire.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
You didn't even know this.
I didn't know that.
Has a record out now as Bright Moments on Luwaka Bop.
Wow.
So there you go.
Look at that.
And the other winner?
Westy Reflector.
This is Westy Reflector's version. Let's get Westy Reflector on the line, and you can let him know that he's one of the two winners.
Cool. You know, I never asked you, what did he win?
Glory.
He's going to be overjoyed until we tell him what he won.
Hello?
Hi, is that Westy?
It is.
Hi, it's Kurt Anderson.
How are you?
I'm good. I wanted to thank you so much for submitting to this challenge we've done.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, thanks. And it's not why I'm calling, but I was really interested in your name. I assume you were not born Westy Reflector, or am I mistaken?
I was not. I do not come from a long line of reflectors. My real name is Dave Westrike.
And I bet you were called Westy.
I was, because there are a lot of Daves in the world.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I did want to thank you. And also, my friend Mark Anthony Thompson is here, and he has been going through all these submissions and wanted to have a few words with you as well.
You won. You're the winner.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much.
Are you sitting down?
I am sitting down, yes. And that's just wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm honored and humbled, especially given the number of stellar submissions.
I know, right?
I wondered, Westy, are the blues a thing that you listen to, care about, or did this just come out of the blue and say, hey, I'll try this?
Playing the blues has always intimidated me. Almost any other musical expression. I mean, you can't fake it unless you've lived it. Unless you've lived it, you can't be true. You can...
Hold on a second. I'm writing these quotes down, man. You're dropping gems.
Well, there's a difference between truth and authenticity.
So what was your thinking in terms of when you approached this? I know what I liked about it, but what did you have any – did the lyrics inform your choices, your selections at all?
You know, no one in the story is in a fixed place.
Right.
So whether it's a physical – Easy Rider is not in a physically fixed place. And Susan Johnson is not in a mentally fixed place. Nobody seems to be fixed. Time or in space in the song.
Well, see, I love that you gave it that much thought because it really, maybe that's why it just appealed to me on so many levels and it just was, you know, my choice like almost from the first time I heard it. And I thought other submissions might shake you out of there, but it stayed with me. And
cool.
I like that you gave it that much thought and that approach.
It's been fantastic talking to you and thanks so much for doing one of the winning songs out of the dozens we got.
Yeah, it was a great version. Thank you for that.
Hey, I appreciate it.
In addition to the two winners, you did 8 honorable mentions, which mm-hmm. were the close to the top of the top.
Right.
And by the way, you are going to play them on your radio show.
Absolutely am. I plan to play them on my radio show, which is called the Honeygun Power Hour, and it is on WGXC.org on your internet systems.
Mark Anthony Thompson, thank you so much.
Ah, my pleasure. Kurt.
Mark Anthony Thompson is also the singer-songwriter known as Chocolate Genius. There's a playlist of all of Mark's top 10 picks at studio360.org, where, in fact, you can listen to every submission we got. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Our show today is all about what's happening in art and culture, not today, but 100 years ago, in 1914. One of the biggest things to happen on stage that year was the debut of George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, which we remember now mainly as the basis for My Fair Lady, about the stuffy, pompous linguist who teaches the Cockney flower girl to speak properly. But the play wasn't supposed to be the love story we know now. Shaw really had other things on his mind. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton explains.
Fact: people love makeover stories. Ever since Cinderella, Rags to Riches has been a surefire hit. So in 1914, when George Bernard Shaw wanted to convince the public that women should get the vote, he wrote a play about a makeover. Pygmalion begins on the streets of London, literally in the gutter, where a girl named Eliza is selling flowers.
I've a right to be if I like, same as you.
This is from the 1938 movie version. She happens to catch the ear of a linguist named Higgins.
Ow!
Ow! Heavens, what a sound!
Higgins bets his friend he can pass her off as an aristocrat.
I shall make a duchess of this draggle-tailed gutter snipe.
Ow!
In 6 months, in three, if she has a good ear and a quick tongue, I'll take her anywhere and pass her off as anything. We start today, now, this minute. Mrs. Pearson?
Cue the makeover montage.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plains.
The play is really about language and the idea that through language, one can raise one's social status, which is something that's really important for that era. Ellen Dolgen is vice president of the International Shaw Society. She says Shaw wanted to get rid of the whole class system. He thought this play would prove his point.
That what we think of as absolutely innate social placement is not. It can be learned, and it can be fudged.
She is a princess.
Except that's not the end. This is where Pygmalion gets interesting. Higgins has won his bet. Eliza is a proper lady. But now she's stuck. She can't go back to selling flowers, and she doesn't want to be Higgins' secretary, or worse, his wife.
I'll speak as I like. You're not my teacher now.
They have this huge fight, a battle of wills.
If I can't have kindness, I'll have independence.
Independence, that's middle-class blasphemy.
I'll let you see whether I'm dependent on you. If you can preach, I can teach. I'll go and be a teacher.
What'll you teach in heaven's name?
What you taught me, I'll teach phonetics.
As far as I'm concerned, by the end of that play, when she stands up to him, she has become both Pygmalion and Galatea because she has chosen to fashion herself.
That's done you, Henry Higgins, it has, and I don't give that for your bullying and your fine talk. When I think of myself crawling under your feet and being trampled on and talked down, when all the time I'd only to lift my finger to be as good as you are.
It's always that sense of freedom to choose. And Eliza wants to create that freedom.
Leonard Connolly taught Shaw at Trent University in Ontario.
And the stage direction for Eliza is she sweeps out. Sweeps out.
Goodbye, Professor Higgins.
And it's kind of sweeping clean of her relationship with Higgins and heading off to this new, brighter, better future for her.
A future doing what? We don't know. Eliza's next move isn't clear, and Higgins is still a pompous jerk. The ending is unresolved, which is just as George Bernard Shaw wanted it. But when the play debuted, he was in for a shock. At the end, after that big fight...
As I've said, Eliza sweeps out!
But instead of turning his back on her, the actor playing Higgins gives her this look. He didn't change any lines, but that look gave the audience exactly what they wanted to see. That Eliza and Higgins had been in love all along, and that after the curtain fell, they'd be together.
Wrong, 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 wrong. I mean, that is the absolute antithesis of what Shaw had in mind.
Apparently, there was nothing Shaw could do to rein this guy in. By the 100th performance, he was throwing flowers after Eliza. And when the play came to the U.S., a critic, one Edwin F. Shallett, wrote,
"If you're looking for a happy ending, with the hero and the heroine joined joyfully together, you will get it in Pygmalion, if you use your imagination a little."
And it kept getting worse. Shaw wrote the screenplay for a movie version in 1938, but the producer secretly filmed his own happy ending. Shaw won an Oscar for a movie he hated. No surprise, he refused to grant the rights to a musical version. But after he died,
"Someone's head resting on my knee, warm and tender as he can be. Who takes good care of me? How wouldn't it be?"
And that's why people think she marries Higgins at the end. It's this song, the lyrics. I never thought about it before.
At the end of My Fair Lady, Higgins repents, Eliza returns, and the final stage direction says there are tears in Eliza's eyes. She understands.
She understands that he has a lot more feelings than he had ever allowed himself to express. And he's lost without her. He's not lost without her because she takes care of the calendar, but she has come to really matter to him, and this is somebody who never let anybody in.
And that is how Pygmalion went from feminist manifesto to chick flick. Boy meets girl, boy changes girl, boy appreciates girl for who she really is. But Shaw didn't want the play to be about the boy. So as a Shavian, what's your assessment of My Fair Lady?
I still like it. I do. I don't like the... No, I do.
In a postscript, Shaw wrote about what really happened to Eliza. After leaving Higgins, she opened a flower shop, married a nice man. They struggled some and ultimately did all right. She even dropped in on Higgins from time to time. But she never, ever loved him. Shaw wrote, "Galatea, the woman who comes to life in the myth, never does quite like Pygmalion. His relation to her is too godlike to be altogether agreeable." For Studio 360, I'm Jenny Lawton.
George Bernard Shaw's play Pygmalion has just had its debut in London and is to come to Broadway before the end of 1914. And now, from the heights of modern drama, we descend, as it were, to the depths of popular fiction. A boy, the infant son of English aristocracy, is orphaned in the West African jungle. He is adopted by a species of ape, unknown to science, and comes to think of himself as one of their kind, growing into a fine example of noble savage. This is the premise of a novel published recently by Mr. Edgar Rice Burroughs. Its title? Tarzan of the Apes. The book details the young ape man's encounter with another human, the beautiful Jane, and his reactions to civilized life. For today's program, we've asked Mr. Jack Handy, the popular humorist and author of Deep Thoughts, to imagine Tarzan's adventures in the United States of the future.
Tarzan in the Village by Jack Handy. This Tarzan. Tarzan, speak now. Listen, Tarzan. Many year ago, Tarzan, Jane have marital difficulty. Jane say Tarzan not care about Jane feeling. Tarzan say, what about Tarzan feeling? Jane leave, go across great ocean to big city. Tarzan follow. Jane file restraining order Tarzan. Tarzan get apartment Greenwich Village, McDougal Street, between Bleecker, West 3rd, 5th story climb up. Tarzan get job chemical bank. Boss say like Tarzan attitude. Maybe make Tarzan comptroller. That crazy time Tarzan life. Tarzan take many drug. Uppers, downers,
acid, Mary Jane,
Purple Haze.
Black Beauties.
Chinese Doorbells.
You name it, Tarzan take it. Many time Tarzan wake up strange apartment, wonder how Tarzan get there. Tarzan ask Tarzan, how Tarzan get here? Tarzan answer, Tarzan not know. Tarzan get fired from chemical bank because high all time. Seem ironic to Tarzan, lose job at chemical bank because take chemicals. Boss not understand irony, even after Tarzan explain him. Tarzan think everyone square, write poetry. Here sample Tarzan poetry. Hey, Mr. Business, go back in hole where come from. Stay there, like aardvark. Tarzan lose all sense reality. One time stare at single spot on leopard skin for whole day. Other time Tarzan try see Bob Dylan in Village Club, wind up going see Phyllis Diller.
My body's in such bad shape I wear prescription underwear.
Not notice difference. That how messed up Tarzan. Low point come when Tarzan climb tree in park. Do Tarzan yell for tourist, get money for drug. Tourists say, you not real Tarzan. Tarzan think, me wish not real Tarzan. Tarzan go back apartment, get big surprise. Jane there, also boy, also cheetah, also Mr. Kim, owner of bodega on corner. What going on? Then Tarzan realize, this intervention. Tarzan get clean, sober. Tarzan Jane go back jungle. Boy cheetah go back Harvard. Tarzan stay straight, not even eat hyena berries. Kids, listen Tarzan, no take drugs. Tarzan lucky, drugs not hurt Tarzan brain. Maybe you not so lucky.
Tarzan in the Village, created for Studio 360 by Jack Handy. Mr. Handy's recent novel, also a book of exotic adventures, is entitled The Stench of Honolulu. Music and sounds for our story were arranged by Miss Jill DeBoff. Our program today will continue with an eyewitness report from Sarajevo on the event that has stunned Europe. You're listening to Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC. Kindly keep listening.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by Lookout, using big data and predictive analytics to protect people and organizations from mobile threats worldwide. More information at lookout.com.
Greetings once again, listeners. This is your host, Kurt Anderson, presenting a special edition of the Studio 360 program devoted to the cultural highlights of the year 1914. The world is reeling from the news of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the presumptive heir to the throne of Austria-Hungary, while visiting Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia. The assassin is reported to be a Yugoslav nationalist, opposed to rule by the Austrian Empire. The killing threatens the already fragile alliances in Europe, and peace-loving people of all nations are deeply concerned. Here now with a detailed account of the events of that day in June is Mr. Alexander Hemon, the Bosnian writer who's a native of Sarajevo.
The Accordion by Alexander Hemon.
The horses are trotting stolidly, and the coach is bobbing steadily, and Archduke Franz Ferdinand's eyelids are listlessly sliding down his corneas. The weighty eyelids are about to reach the bottom, but then the horse on the left raises its tail, embarrassingly similar to the tassel on the Archduke's resplendent helmet, and the Archduke can see the horse's anus slowly opening, like a camera aperture. The coach is passing between two tentacles of an ostensibly exultant throng. They wave little flags and cheer in some monkey language. Would it be called Bosnian? Wonders the Archduke. Children with filthy faces and putrid cracked teeth run up and down between the legs of the crowd. The Archduke recognizes the secret police with their impeccable mustaches, with stern black hats that clearly look grotesque among blood-red fezes, much like topsy-turvy flower pots with short tassels, and women with little curtains over their faces. The secret police stand stiff, throwing skillful side glances, waiting for the opportunity to show off their alertness. The left horse is dropping turd like dark, deflated tennis balls. The shallow, obscure river behind the back of the Archduke's foreign cunning denizens is reeking of rotten sauerkraut. The Archduke looks at the Archduchess and sees her face in a cramp of disgust. It would be very unseemly if she starts vomiting again in front of all these people, he thinks. The coach rolls between two cordons of smirking people waving ridiculous tiny flags and vapid marble-faced secret policemen. The Archduke then sees a man with an accordion stretched over his chest. The man is smiling sincerely, it appears. He may even be delighted. He doesn't seem to be playing the accordion, just holding it. The Archduke's gaze breaks through the crowd, and he can now see that one of the keys is missing. He can see the dark rectangle in place of the missing key. The coach passes the man, and the Archduke thinks he can sense the man's gaze on his back. He's tempted to turn around, but that would obviously be unseemly. The Archduke wonders about these strange people, about this man who doesn't seem to possess any hatred toward him and the Empire, not yet at least, and he begins to wonder, what happened to that key? Can you play a song without that key? How would Liebestod sound with one of the notes never being played? Maybe that man never played that key. Maybe he'll never play that note in his entire life. Strange people, thinks the Archduke. He decides to tell the Archduchess about the man with the accordion. Perhaps it would cheer her up. There's a man with an accordion, announces the Archduke into the Archduchess's ear. The Archduchess winces as though he's delirious. What are you talking about? He leans towards her. There's a man. But then he sees a pistol and a straight, tense arm behind it, and a young, scrawny man at the end of the arm with a thin mustache and fiery eyes. He sees the pistol retching and bursts of light at the pistol's mouth. He feels something pushing him against the seat and then punching him in his belly, and all the sounds have disappeared. Besides the quick swelling, incomprehensible fear that he can do nothing about and tries to ignore, all he can think of is an evening at Marling. The Archduchess played Liebestod on the piano, much too slowly, while he sat in the armchair by the fireplace, feeling the heat on the left side of his back. He wasn't listening to the Archduchess. He was struggling not to doze off, and then he had a rapid thought, which he immediately suppressed. Oh my God, how vernacular and ungraceful was the Archduchess's beauty, and how unbearably vapid and stupid Liebestod really was. He wants to tell her he's painfully sorry now, but the Archduchess, her face frozen in repulsion, the Archduchess is already dead. Most of this story is a consequence of irresponsible imagination and shameless speculation, a case in point. The Archduke died in a car, which took a wrong turn and then virtually parked in front of the assassin, whose pants were soaked with urine. Parts of it, however, washed against my shores, having floated on the sea of history books, dotted with islands of black and white photographs. A considerable part reached me after it passed through the tunnels and mazes of family memories and legends. For the man with the accordion was none other than my great-grandfather, freshly arrived in Bosnia from Ukraine. He was in Sarajevo for the first and only time in his life to obtain papers for the promised piece of land, the bait that brought him to Bosnia. He was a peasant and had never been in a big city. The fuss and giddiness that he encountered in the city blessed by the Archduke's visit and then cursed by his death overwhelmed him, so much so that he spent nearly a fifth of his savings buying the accordion from a gypsy at a city market. By the time he got back to his new home, on a hill called Vuciak, World War I was well on its way. He was recruited within a couple of weeks and went to Galicia to fight for the Empire, where he died of dysentery. The accordion outlived him by some 50 cacophonic years, losing a few more keys along the way. It met its demise with a discordant accordion sigh after my blind uncle Theodore, a grenade had exploded in his hands when he was 6, threw himself on the bed where the accordion helplessly lay. Uncle Theodore is now stuck in the Serb part of Bosnia. Most of my family is scattered across Canada. This story was written in Chicago, where I live, on the subway, after a long day of arduous work as a parking assistant, Anno Domini 1996.
That story was The Accordion by Alexander Hemon, which he read. His most recent published work is The Book of My Lives. The composer and accordionist Will Holzhauser scored the story.
We conclude our special episode of Studio 360 on the artistic developments that are making 1914 such an extraordinary year for the cultural scene of America and the world. Whether the subjects of our conversations today will be remembered a century hence, it shall be up to listeners of the future to decide. This is Kurt Anderson, and I hope you'll join us again next time when I'll speak normally for the entire hour. But until then, Studio 360 is co-produced by Public Radio International and station WNYC. Our production staff includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Matt Frasica, Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson, Shruti Panamaneni,
Jill Dubois,
Sophia Nguyen,
Ariel Roland Waring,
Marshall Bright,
Hannah Alonji.
Our special thanks this week go to Andy Lancet, WQXR's Jeff Spurgeon, and as always, to WNYC's Christopher Bannon. Our theme music is by Mr. David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You are living in an episode of Star Trek every day of your life.
Kirk here.
Scotty here, Captain.
Think about it. The communicator could only talk to other members of the Enterprise crew. They should have been able to talk to anybody in the universe.
Inventing the cell phone and other feats of science fiction. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.